Beautiful. Thank you, Adrian. I actually took the chance to look on Truth Unity, which is a website that I highly recommend. Metaphysically, the New Jerusalem represents an association of all people in peace based on spiritual understanding. How beautiful. And last week, if you were here, you remember that Britt ended the service by telling us we have to end the war within us as we pray for peace out there. We have to end the war within us as we pray for peace out there. We've been told to love your neighbor as you love yourself. And Gail reminds us of the importance of that. And really, we can only love our neighbor as much as we love ourselves. And we've further been told to, in fact, love our enemies, which can be a challenge, especially when we remember that we have enemies within. There is this divide within us, which is why we proclaim unity. And many people have said that the original divide away from our oneness was the one around sex, male and female. And it's one that I think more than ever we need to heal. My mother recently introduced me to the work of Riane Eisler, a brilliant author. Listen to what she says in her latest book, Nurturing Our Humanity. Quote, "As long as boys and men learn to equate real masculinity with violence and control, we cannot really expect to end the arms buildups that are today bankrupting our world and the terrorism and aggressive warfare that threaten our survival. Nor can we realistically expect an end to racism, anti-Semitism, and the other ugly isms as long as children learn, before their critical faculties are in place, to accept a model of our species in which one kind of person dominates another." Unquote. So my talk title today is Women, Love, and Power. I wanted to explore these three things as they relate to each other, because too often I think we associate power with masculinity, victory, and force. It seemed like an appropriate topic during Women's History Month, and during this time when we're seeing toxic masculinity, quite frankly, on full display. But I'm not talking about men versus women. This issue is way bigger than that. It gets at our entire way of conceiving reality. It's as big as the erroneous belief that the world is flat or at the center of the universe, or that heaven and hell are real places that God out there sends us. It's this deep notion that what is feminine is inherently wrong, less valuable, or completely unimportant. And this leads to tremendous suffering. Now, what do I mean when I say feminine? Well, really, that is whatever we say it is. It's what we believe. It's ultimately a construct, but it's a persistent one. We've defined these gender roles in very solid ways, and they really confine us all. This culture disowns the feminine and anything associated with that. Now, right off the bat, let me be clear, I love masculinity. But cut off from the balancing energy of femininity, we get knowledge without wisdom, strength without justice, leadership without compassion or empathy. So my point today is not to disparage the masculine, it's to encourage us all to reclaim the feminine, because doing so is key to our healing, individually and collectively. I once spent the day with a family whose father continuously scolded his 6-year-old son for doing things like a girl. He'd say, "Don't sneeze like that. That's how girls sneeze." It was hard to watch, but I was younger and, quite frankly, afraid to intervene. But feel the effects of growing up with a message that severe, that being like a girl is not just wrong, it's disgusting to your own father. The straitjacket of narrow masculinity locks us in and limits our lives in huge ways. This affects what men think they can do and how they treat women. And it sets up standards for how women are to behave if they want to succeed in a so-called man's world. Now, there are plenty of theories out there about how we got here. Eckhart Tolle in A New Earth asks, what is it that suddenly made men feel threatened by the female? The evolving ego in them. It knew it could gain full control of our planet only through the male form. And to do so, it had to render the female powerless. And so, the creation story posits that Adam came first and Eve emerged out of him. So men are primary and women come from us. It's in the Bible. For the record, not only do we all emerge from women, but also we all, including men, start out as female in the womb. The Y chromosome kicks in later during gestation after a number of features have been established. It reshapes some of those features into male ones, but we start as women, guys. So we literally have the feminine within us. It's a fact. Now, why is it that that's something many men would hate to know? Well, we've been trained. As Oscar Hammerstein said, you have to be carefully taught. We've been taught that Eve ushered us into original sin, and we are all thereby cursed. And this misinterpretation of the story has been used to oppress women for millennia and to suppress anything feminine within our culture. After the story of Adam and Eve, we get the Exodus from Egypt, which culminates with the Ten Commandments. Now, how does that relate to repressing the feminine? Well, Leonard Schlein, in The Alphabet Versus the Goddess, offers this astonishing perspective. Quote, "The first commandment, I am the Lord thy God, thou shalt have no other gods before me, announces the disappearance of the goddess. The meta message of the commandment is, I am the only deity. I am a man, and I do not have, nor do I need, a wife or consort. Given that the Hebrews and Moses emerged from Egypt, the most goddess-worshipping culture in the ancient world, the first commandment represented a sharp rupture with the past. And given that all people acknowledge that life is a conjoining of masculine and feminine principles, the exclusion of any feminine presence from the first commandment makes it the most radical sentence ever written." Unquote. Now that's a quote. Leonard Schlein speaks in this book about men's tendency to favor the left brain and lead toward dominance over women, to prefer logic and words to beauty and images, to favor time over timelessness, and obedience over cooperation. So with that in mind, let's reconsider the first five commandments. Number one, God's a man, no goddess. Number two, let's restrict images. Three, watch our words. Four, watch time. Five, obey your parents. So we have a kind of masculine coup in five commandments. God's a man, let's restrict images, focus on words and time, and obey authority. Did you ever wonder why those are first before we even get to murder? Now, to be clear, the commandments are great. There's metaphysical interpretations of them. And even just literally, they have set an important standard for civilization. But I think it's important to at least consider the mindset that may have set them up. Now, Rhian Eisler speaks of domination societies versus those of partnership. Domination societies, like our own, are based on a male-centric ethos of winners and losers. Partnership societies, like many Native American cultures and others, are in tune with the feminine and concepts associated with femininity, like cooperation, compassion, seeing things in spectrums rather than binaries, using curiosity over judgment, valuing nature, having lots of different emotions, not just anger. Now, of course, no society is entirely based in domination or partnership. So she speaks of it as a spectrum between the two and points to our modern civilization as disturbingly stuck on the domination end. And this is not just something that's out there in the world outside of unity, because each of us lives within this paradigm of dominance, which manifests as self-shame, competition, and the desire to defeat rather than cooperate with or befriend our enemies. The domination paradigm cuts across right and left, permeates our movies and mythology, informs our notions of success and personal worth, and blinds us to our own inherent and sometimes complex beauty. It can be very hard to see this operating in us precisely because we're so steeped in it. Let me give a personal example. It's only recently I realized that what really sold me on my first boyfriend was the fact that no one could tell he was gay, which is code for he was not effeminate. I had to hide that. As I matured and my life grew richer, my choices expanded greatly. I began to wear more colors, better fitting clothing, to express a fuller spectrum of emotion than the almost monotone one I entered therapy with. Now, I'm still very much in the process of embracing my femininity within me, to find a balance of energies. Again, not about denying the masculine, rather it's about reintegrating and loving our feminine aspects, or those aspects we've been taught to associate with the feminine and have been taught are therefore inferior. Breathe. I know this is a lot, but it's important, I think, to get real with where we're at in order to heal. In other words, you have to be honest during the prayer request. So we need a way out of this, right? Maybe, a way shower. And of course we have one. It's just, as Bishop Spong so memorably put it, it's never really been tried. I'm talking, of course, about the way of Jesus, not so much the guy on the cross, but rather the one on that mountain. Now, how does this man fit into an embrace of femininity, you may ask? Well, again, Ms. Eisler, in her classic book, The Chalice and the Blade, she says, when we look closely, not only at what Jesus taught, but at how he went about disseminating his message, time and again, we find that what he was preaching was the gospel of a partnership society. He rejected the dogma that high-ranking men, priests, nobles, rich men, and kings are the favorites of God. He mingled freely with women, thus openly rejecting the male supremacist norms of his time. And in sharp contrast to the views of later Christian sages who actually debated whether women had a soul, Jesus did not preach the ultimate dominator message, that women are spiritually inferior to men. So Jesus sought to integrate women back into the community, as we just heard in that wonderful quote from Rhian Eisler. Women played a key role in hosting him and following him and literally supporting him, not just supporting his message, they tithed to him. So listen to this. This is from the Passion Translation of Luke 8:3. Many other women who supported Jesus's ministry from their own personal finances also traveled with him. How wonderful to have this translation that fully shines a light on that, from their own personal finances. So Jesus's message resonated with women. They literally valued his message, not just because he let them hang around, but because he used his authority as a man to bring back feminine qualities like love, listening, and non-violence, to name a few. And he consistently challenged the status quo, the culture that dominated, devalued, and shamed women. Let's go even deeper. And here's where I think it gets really interesting. Because Jesus's message, the one so often ignored, challenges the domination paradigm and suggests a whole new way of interacting with the world and dealing with conflict. Theologian Walter Wink points to the radical nonviolence that Jesus preached. In just one part of Matthew are several daring instructions whose meaning almost everyone has missed, but this theologian has put them in context and reinterpreted them in a way that makes them finally mesh, I think, with the rest of Jesus's message. So here's the New International Version of Matthew 5, 38 to 45. You've heard that it was said, eye for eye and tooth for tooth, but I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. Give to the one who asks you, and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. You've heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. Okay, so let's look at this. First of all, we hear, do not resist an evil person. Well, the word that's been translated from Greek is really better translated as stand against, as in militarily, when two lines in the ancient world, two lines of men would stand against each other. So Jesus is really saying, don't violently resist, don't join their battle. Because then he actually specifies some ways to non-violently resist. He says, if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. It's rather specific. How odd. Well, it turns out that in the ancient world, you only hit people with your right hand. If they were inferior to you, you used the back of your hand. So if I use my right hand and hit backhanded, I'm hitting you across your right cheek. If you turn the other cheek, you are in effect saying, you may hit me, but only as my equal. A four-handed slap was the way that you hit someone who was equal. Now he goes on to say, if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. And this was an actual practice in Jesus's time, where somebody who owned the land, for example, would be owed money and they'd sue the tenant farmer and take his shirt. If you then give your coat as well, you were standing naked in front of the person. And nakedness in that time was shameful for the viewer, helping to awaken the consciousness of the abuser. So with both turn the other cheek and give them also your shirt, we're awakening the conscience of the abuser, much as the freedom fighters did when they integrated the lunch counters peacefully. When they were met with violence and stayed peaceful, it helped to awaken the conscience of America. Then Jesus goes on to say, if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. And this sounds really odd to us now, But there was actually a practice where Roman soldiers were allowed to force any Jewish person to carry their load for 1 mile. And this was so controversial that there were, in fact, Jewish assassins who would go killing Romans. And Jesus is saying, no, gratefully go with them that second mile. How surprising is this in each of these cases to be offering generosity in the face of abuse? It's astonishing. And then this segues right into love your enemy. Why? Because God does that and you're God's child, so own that. Love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. So to me, this helps it all mesh as a radical statement of a kind of generous, almost ferocious love, none of which is easy. And it's so outside our normal way of thinking that it seems that we've missed it and dismissed it. I mean, turn the other cheek sounds weak. What am I, a doormat? But if we put it in context, it becomes profound in unexpected ways. And you might wonder how we missed this. It seems to me that the dominance paradigm had no reason to explore that part of the Bible. It was better to dismiss it as one of Jesus's silly, impossible, irrelevant sayings. Let's just focus on him up on that cross. So the message of Jesus is certainly not about rolling over and accepting injustice, but it's also not about joining the injustice, fighting fire with fire, so to speak, and thereby helping to set the world ablaze. It's about meeting the world with love. Radical, redemptive love, as Martin Luther King used to say. Because, as John Lewis so memorably put it, hate is too heavy a burden to bear. For me, for the person doing the hating. As we look at the news, it can feel discouraging as this domination paradigm rolls over the Ukraine, bringing unspeakable suffering in its wake. But let us remember that whatever the right solution is in the short term for this one problem, the bigger issue is what got us here. The seeds that come from within each of us will grow the world we inhabit tomorrow. Because we are part of a mighty ripple. And what we practice today matters. We can embody the belief that regular people are inherently wondrous and blessed by knowing that about ourselves and treating others that way too. When we devalue ourselves and then try to bless others, we give from an empty cup. And as Becca reminded us last week, blessing multiplies, so we're just multiplying from an empty place. When we value ourselves exclusively and ignore others, then we're living in self-imposed exile, a place of fear and doubt. But by identifying with our fullness and loving that completely, we shine out like a light on the hill. Debbie Ford expresses this brilliantly in her classic, The Dark Side of the Light Chasers. It's no longer my mission, she says, to be perfect. My mission now is to be whole, to be complete, to be perfect and imperfect at the same time. My mission now is to listen to my inner wisdom and to live my life as fully as possible. My commitment now is to love myself as much as humanly possible, for I know that when I do, I will in return be able to love you. In her work, Debbie Ford invites us to explore and even befriend the shadow within us, the parts of ourselves we've disowned, and which thereby often run our lives. we've made femininity into a collective shadow, which affects us all. For some, it may seem like we'll give up power as we come into balance, that being vulnerable, for example, would make us weak. And that's what the overly masculine culture and brain tell us. But actually, we gain power in joy, emotions of all kinds, in love, compassion, vitality, better relationships. Things that can't be measured, but ironically are the only ones that count. Well, we banished the goddess long ago. I say let's reclaim her as our friend, our mentor, our equal. If we're made in God's likeness, then it stands to reason that God is beyond gender and sex and is therefore all of us. God is all of us on the planet, and also God is all that is within us. That's the God I want to proclaim and demonstrate. And I say it's time to bring our big, loving, all-embracing, feminine, masculine, gender-fluid God out of the closet. And if that notion makes you even a little bit uncomfortable, good. Let's stretch and allow discomfort as we grow. Let's be curious and open to new ways that are outside of our comfort zone, ways that expand our horizons. Let me finish the talk today with this. Because of the trans community, the word they is now officially recognized as two kinds of pronouns, plural, of course, and now also as a singular gender-neutral pronoun. Now remember, we are individuations of the one God, the many as one. So maybe God is not so much a he or she, but rather they, both plural and singular. God is the one power. May they bless you as you awaken to the fullness of life. Thank you. Let's take a journey now beyond our normal focus. Moving away from any earthly divisions, away from any struggle, as we allow all forms to be as they are. We focus on the spaciousness that is everywhere surrounding us, leaving forms behind, leaving problems far behind, as we broaden our horizons, experiencing the vastness of it all. This is a place of pure possibility and potential, of openness. Breathe it in. Feel its magnificence. Breathe it in. Experience the pure peace of this, your home. Breathe this in. Light is here, and the darkness frames it. and they live in balance. Any forms or thoughts are diffuse, light as clouds, and we move right through them. There's space between everything. Spaciousness and possibility are the norm. Space between objects, between words, space between and within thoughts. You are here in the center of all of this. You're the light and the dark, the form and the space. You are the dance of life, always in perfect harmony. You are in the center of all of this, and all of this is in the center of you. Welcome to the infinite place called you. Welcome the infinite place called you.